I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Right before Christmas in 1991, a fire tore through Cameron Todd Willingham's small Texas house, killing his three young daughters. He quickly became a suspect, was convicted of murder, and executed in 2004 after a trial that was riddled with questionable evidence and inconsistent testimony. Our guest, Edward Zwick, has made a film, Trial by Fire, that raises a host of questions about Willingham's guilt. The film stars Laura Dern playing Elizabeth Gilbert, who befriended Willingham in prison and came to believe in his innocence. It also stars Jack O'Connell, who plays Willingham. Here's a scene from Trial by Fire when police question him after the fire.
Can you think of why anyone would want to hurt your family?
No, sir. We had three of the prettiest babies anybody could have asked for. Off and on, we'd fight and break up for a while, but it was always the babies that brought us back together. Neither of us could have lived without them kids. Sometimes I wish Amber had never woke me up.
Now, Todd, you've been in trouble before.
Yes, sir.
A couple of those times when we asked you what happened, you didn't exactly tell the truth, isn't that so?
No, sir.
But you're telling the truth now.
Yes, sir.
Trial by Fire opens on May 17th. Edward Zwick is an award-winning filmmaker, producer, and screenwriter who has directed many movies, including Glory, The Last Samurai, Defiance, Legends of the Fall, Blood Diamonds. He produced Shakespeare in Love, for which he got an Academy Award. He was nominated for an Oscar for Traffic, and he co-created 30-something. And he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Edward Zwick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Did Texas execute an innocent man?
Yes, they did. It's, really regarded by many as the signal case against the death penalty. And it's only been revealed to be more and more of an abomination.
And we're talking about questionable evidence, arson investigators who seem to believe that...
The case was a catalog of everything that's wrong with the criminal justice system. It wasn't just junk science, which led the charge, but also it was... the withholding of exculpatory evidence, the use of jailhouse snitches in exchange for reduced sentences, and the lack of means to afford a proper defense. In fact, very little defense. The jury was out for 45 minutes.
The Texas Forensic Science Commission basically, said that the evidence, the arson evidence, just did not hold up.
Well, that's what they said 10 years later. Right. After his execution, they formed a commission, and the commission was about to issue a report to that effect, and Governor Perry dissolved the commission before it could issue its report.
So is this your argument against the death penalty?
Yeah, there's a very famous quote by Justice Scalia that says, should it ever be revealed that an innocent man was put to death, that his name would be shouted from the rooftops. I think this is that shout.
And yet people, I would say outside of Texas, probably have never heard of Cameron Todd Willingham.
That's right. Although, I mean, he's become a bit of an avatar to something. The Innocence Project has taken on the case, and I think will eventually he'll be exonerated eventually should this kind of pressure continue.
One of the prisoners who's on death row, they're talking about capital punishment, and he says, "If you ain't got the capital, you get the punishment."
Yeah, Brian Stevenson, who's a wonderful voice for reform, once said that it's better to be rich and guilty than be poor and innocent.
And Willingham himself claimed from the beginning until his execution that he was an innocent man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's also a difficult man, we should say. We're talking domestic violence, drinking, clearly has a temper, doesn't really have a job when we meet him. He's got Satanist tattoos and posters.
Yeah.
I mean, he's complicated and not particularly likable when we first meet him.
Yeah, I mean, I would say disreputable and worse. And I think that actually makes the story all the more significant because all those things are true, yet not deserving of his fate. I think society has a tendency to pick out the other and to scapegoat that person when something inexplicable happens. I think this is a time in which demonization is a theme in our culture, and I think he was a victim of just that.
And it was pretty clear from, and I've read about it, and I saw some documentaries about it and saw your film as well, is that the police and others, they knew this guy because he had been arrested before. They just thought he was guilty from the get-go.
Yeah, and that's often, you know, the case in which they've anointed someone and then they prove that case. I mean, you know, look, journalists are guilty of that as well. They have a point to make and they look to make that point as opposed to... the difference was that David Grann, who wrote the article in The New Yorker, went down to Texas without any preconceptions. He had no notion that that was going to be the story that he would write. And you watch as it unfolds for him. And for me, what was really interesting in the article and then what led me to shape the film was that you look at this case, as does the jury, as do the people of Corsicana, and initially you condemn him. And therefore you become complicit. And your participation in the movie is more active, I think, because as it begins to unfold, you realize that you are as responsible.
Did you then have access to court transcripts? I have David Grann's article right here. I know that was the basis for this film in many ways, but also the letters that he wrote from prison.
Yeah, Elizabeth Gilbert, who is, you'll tell this story, I'm sure, soon about this woman who took on his case almost randomly. But she gave us all of her correspondence with Todd, her letters and Todd's. We had all of the transcripts. We spoke to many of the lawyers who have since tried to intervene. Right. And so, yeah, we had great access.
You cast Jack O'Connell, who I have to say is British, but he does have a Texas accent in this film. You cast him to play Todd, and I kept looking at him saying, I know this face. Mm-hmm. And then I remember, yes, Godless.
That's right. Yeah, he did that very well, actually. Look, if he were sitting here now and we're speaking, he's from Derby. It's a very difficult accent to even understand, and yet he transforms utterly with great work. He worked with a dialect coach who's probably the dean of that, a man named Tim Monick. He worked with me with Leonardo DiCaprio in Blood Diamond and created that wonderful accent that Leo did. But the thing about Jack is his willingness to embrace those dark qualities that you refer to. Because had we chosen, not chosen, but had it been a story about a man who was utterly Job-like and innocent, I think it could have bordered into sentimentality. Mm-hmm. And this plays against that, I think.
You also have Emily Mead. She plays his wife, Stacy. And again, I was looking at her, saying, yeah. I know I've
Who is
seen
that?
This face
Who is
before.
That person?
And it was The Deuce is where I remember seeing her.
Yeah, she's great. And, you know, she disappears into that part and all the others.
So what was it about these two actors then that you wanted to play such pivotal roles?
Well, you know, that's a very ineffable choice. You just feel something and it feels right. I think I like the fact that they didn't carry with them any baggage of persona of other parts that you would recognize, and you would really believe the authenticity of who they were.
Well, let me play another scene from this film, Trial by Fire. And this is Todd Willingham's wife, Stacy, again played by Emily Mead. And she's on the stand at her husband's trial being questioned about his character and whether he beat her. And this is what she says.
You don't understand, Todd. He's not like that. Todd would never do anything to hurt those babies. He loved those babies with all his heart. He treated those babies better than anybody else did. He would feed them and change their diapers, and he potty trained them, and you are not listening. Everybody's in here making up lies. No one's paying attention to the facts. No one's telling the f***ing truth.
The witnesses
excuse. No one's telling the truth or listening to anything we're saying.
Young lady.
When do we get a chance to say the truth?
You will step down.
I'm sorry.
Is that from the trial?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about the trial is what came out is that Stacy herself had been, her mother had been killed by her father. So she came from an environment of great complexity and pain. And Stacy, having staunchly defended Todd, then later turned against him for reasons that were, I think, inexplicable and yet makes sense.
I mean, it is in some ways such a human story because you've got people who struggle with each other and you see their relationship. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult to watch because there's violence actually on both sides. Mm-hmm. And yet there's this interesting chemistry between the two of them.
There is. Well, I mean, I thought about, you know, Johnny and June and some relationships that are fighting and I'll save that word for, you know, for a beep. But, you know, I think what's interesting in the movie is that it is as interesting to me as it is this depiction of a set of relationships as it is about some institutional failure. Mm-hmm. And the relationship between Todd and Elizabeth is as beautiful and as soulful as anything. And it's a very interesting juxtaposition against the story. It gives the movie, I think, its life and its beating heart, which it needs, because otherwise it would be too difficult to watch.
And we should say that Laura Dern plays Elizabeth mm-hmm. Gilbert, and they begin as pen pals, mm-hmm. and then she visits him, and it's the beginning of this relationship, but also her belief that he's an innocent man.
Yeah, she's not a lawyer or anything of the sort. She does something almost randomly. She's at a moment in her life that's a little bit at sea, and agrees to write a letter, and gets this letter back, and it strikes something in her. They begin a correspondence that becomes this relationship as she begins to visit him. And those visits are at the heart of the movie.
Well, and I love in the visits, it seems that there's a camera on his face and a camera on her face. And you watch them mm-hmm. looking at each other. And the first time they meet, it's almost like an awkward blind date or something. Like, what do you say to someone who's on death row?
Well, you know, I did something very deliberately, which is to say I worked with Laura independently. She met Elizabeth, worked with her. We went to prisons. We talked about the case. I also worked with Jack, and we shot his scenes separately. I deliberately kept them apart.
Oh, interesting.
And it wasn't until we shot those scenes that I put them opposite each other, so it would have that same quality of discomfort and growth into the various things as we shot them in sequence.
And we should, it sounds like Elizabeth Gilbert, how involved was she in the making of the film?
Very. She was exceedingly generous. Her story is very painful as well.
Oh, yeah.
But she was a great help in terms of opening a window into Todd, because she knew him and then had his letters. But also, she was great for Laura, and Laura great for her, because, you know, as a writer, you try to put yourself inside someone's experience to the best of your ability. But sometimes you make mistakes which are, you know, forgivable, because they come out of a kind of earnestness. And the temptation to describe Elizabeth as this a little bit more beatific figure, once Laura got to know her and saw her humor and her self-mockery, she came more to life. And that's what happens when you work with a great actress, because she makes you better, not just in her work, but in her influence over yours.
That's Edward Zwick, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new film. It opens on May 17th, and it's called Trial by Fire, based on an execution that happened in Texas a number of years ago. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Edward Zwick. He's a filmmaker, producer, screenwriter, and he's got a new film that opens on May 17th called Trial by Fire. Let me play one more scene from this new film. And again, this is Elizabeth Gilbert, played by Laura Dern. She has gotten involved in this case of Todd Willingham, believing that he's innocent. It begins with a pen pal relationship, and this is a letter that Todd then sends to her at the start of their relationship.
Death row inmates aren't allowed to associate with the general population. We have no contact at all with the outside. No one in the whole world knows I exist. I feel like I am slowly being erased. Please excuse my writing. I'm learning to express myself better. I've added your name to my visitors list in case you decide to come. Meantime, I hope your life turns forever forward. Yours, Cameron Todd Willingham.
How many letters between the two of them? I mean, she kept them, right?
Oh, yeah. I have never actually counted. There were many, and they were over years.
And what we hear, I mean, as I listen to the letters and their conversation, I mean, it does feel as if he becomes a better person in prison.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the ironies. This is someone who'd never really been exposed to that kind of attention and books and time to reflect and anything like that. And it's even an argument for a kind of the possibility of the change from a certain kind of toxic masculinity to a real soulfulness.
You do. I hope this isn't giving too much away. I mean, it's based on a true story. Mm-hmm. He is executed in 2004. Mm-hmm. The camera does not turn away from his execution.
Well,
and we don't get to see executions in this country.
No, I think I felt that if one indeed condemned him, as the audience tends to in the beginning, I think they're then obliged to see all of it. And it's obviously a very powerful scene, and one that we were all dreading, but there is in it something oddly transcendent, because of what has happened with them and what it leads to.
It's interesting that we were talking about this before going on the air, that there is this interest, even almost obsessive interest, in true crime stories these days.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about that. I mean, I wonder if it was just finally we'd exhausted the old tropes of crime and punishment like Law and Order, or I wonder if there's some new burgeoning interest, particularly among younger people, in injustice. You know, we have an unpunished predator at the top of the system right now. There's an awareness of our impotence to change certain things as they're happening around us. And I know that there are the podcasts like Serial and Making of a Murder, and there's one called My Favorite Murder. They're very very popular.
I've heard of that. Yep.
19 million hits a month, I think. You know, so I think there is, and maybe even there's some quest or desire for authenticity, unless it's just perverse. Mm-hmm. Or fascination, I don't know.
Or the sort of prurience, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's probably got a piece of that in there.
You bet, you bet.
Let's talk a little bit about how you started in the filmmaking world. And I read it began in high school, not filmmaking, but interest in acting and theater.
Yeah, I was that theater kid.
You were.
I couldn't stop. And I think in some way my whole career has been an attempt to recapitulate those feelings, the passion and the intensity of that.
Those high school dramas?
Yep, you bet.
Which ones?
Oh, please. There were the predictable ones and less predictable. I went to a high school that actually was very enlightened in its system, but we also did, you know, we did musicals. But I got to do a production of The Visit by Durenmaat.
In high school?
In high school.
Wow.
We did The Playboy of the Western World by John Millington Singh. So it was a little more evolved, and it was actually a very interesting moment. It was in the 70s, and it was in the suburbs of Chicago, and many of the student teachers who came were avoiding the draft by, you know, keeping their deferments in graduate school. And there was a couple of men, one in particular, a guy named Mark Lamus, who was just a student teacher when I was maybe a junior or senior, right, who then went on to form the Hartford Rep Company and was a wonderful influence. And I was blessed with those kind of, you know, teachers.
Did you act in some of these plays? You have a funny look on your face.
God, it was
a very innocent question.
Enough to know that I never would again.
Really?
Yeah.
But you recognize it in other people, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the thing that kept me from being any good at all was that I had some real interest in the whole story and the stagecraft and the storytelling, and I didn't have the self-absorption that was enough to be so internal as to shut everything else out.
I was trying to think, so what is an Edward Zwick film? I mean, I think we know, like, we would recognize a Woody Allen film or a Scorsese film. I mean, you just feel like, almost from the opening credits, it's like, you know what you are going to see, even though it's obviously a different movie every time. But I don't think that applies to you so much.
Well, it might have to do with having been first trained in the repertory theater, doing Sam Shepard one night and Molière the next, and it might have to do with a certain intellectual promiscuity that I'm interested in any number of subjects and forms, and I remember once reading a quote from Satchel Paige that says, always stay a moving target.
Oh, And you like that?
I do. Yeah.
So we, I also like we can't categorize
no,
you, right?
I also like being a little bit scared.
Oh.
I like putting myself in situations that where I really have to pay attention and I don't have some reliable habits to fall back on.
And being scared makes you more creative, more,
yeah,
take,
I think you
more
reach,
willing to take a risk.
Yeah, I think you explore different places inside and you discover things about yourself. And after a certain amount of times as a professional, I mean, I think about what you do for a living. You, mm-hmm. you do your homework every day and confront a new subject that you didn't know anything about. And it allows you to be a little bit of a perpetual student. And that keeps me alive.
Yeah. I do think, though, you said relationship several times
yes.
during our conversation. And that, I mean, if there is something that seems to interest you over
Absolutely.
These many years.
And even in the context of the broadest canvas, and that could be the Gulf War or it could be the war on drugs or it could be terrorism, the relationships between the people are at the center. And that is what interests me the most. And that's a link between the TV I've done and the movies that right. I've done because – In a larger canvas, it creates this edifice on which the relationships can rest. It also gives you a legitimate cause to have this drama for nothing, and the intensity doesn't seem forced as it does sometimes in domestic drama. It just is there.
Let me play. There, so many films. I picked two.
Okay.
We could have picked many more, but I wanted to play Glory, a scene from Glory. This is the story of the 54th Regiment of the Massachusetts Volunteer Infantry, one of the first all-black regiments in the Union Army. Stars Matthew Broderick. He plays Colonel Robert Shaw. Denzel Washington as Private Silas Tripp. He's a fugitive slave. And in this scene, Tripp, played by Denzel Washington, watches as Corporal Thomas Searles, played by Andre Brower, straightens his uniform as he looks in a mirror.
Yeah, button up that collar. Suck in that gut. Tuck in them big black lips. Lighten your skin. Shrink up that nose.
I don't have to listen to this.
Where you going, boy?
Let me buy.
Let you buy? Let you buy. Let me tell you something, boy. You can march like the white man. You can talk like him. You can learn his songs. You can even wear his suits. But you ain't never gonna be nothing to him but an ugly-ass chimp in a blue suit.
A scene from Glory. I love this film, I have to say. And that, of course, is Denzel Washington, Morgan Freeman, Andre Brower. This was 30 years ago.
Yeah, I'm aware. The funny thing is they're actually going to re-release it in theaters this summer.
They
did a 4K restoration, and I guess the TCM is going to put it in theaters in 600 theaters for a couple of days this summer.
Did you have anything to do with that?
Nope.
What? You have worked with Denzel Washington several times, The Siege, Courage Under Fire.
Yep. And we remain good friends. This was the first time, though, on that movie that we worked together.
Was this the beginning of his career? This is 19...
Very early. I think,
89.
Yeah, he had done St. Elsewhere, and I think he'd done Soldier's Story. I think that was about all.
What do you look for? I mean, we've been talking about some of the actors
sure.
that you have worked with. Was there something... I mean, he's such a great actor.
Yeah.
What can I say?
You know,
silly question.
Yeah, well, you know, there is that fascination... with what is happening inside. And it's been my experience that those movie stars have so much going on that they don't reveal, and yet the camera intuits it and sees it inside. They are pretty much all geniuses of a particular kind, not traditional, not necessarily academic, but so such antic minds and such fascinating processes that you can't look away, and then they let you in every now and then, and you're grateful.
Is it the camera or is it the director, meaning you?
You know, I think, look, you, the director tries to see things. I mean, I've always liked to think of casting movie stars as actors rather than for their persona. I also think that it's a little bit like the difference between driving a big truck with no power steering or driving a Ferrari. Not that I've done a lot of either, but you know, you have to crank a truck around and, you know, get it to turn. And with a Ferrari, if you just touch the wheel, it goes screaming around a corner. And those brilliant actors, you just really create an environment in which they can be and which they are comfortable, and things around them are authentic, which is to say the words are right. the staging is right, the props are right, the lighting is right, and they then exist within it and then create within it and feel safe and free and protected to just go. And you're pretty smart if you just stay the heck out of their way.
Well, I was wondering, under those circumstances, where are you? Are you quietly observing in the corner?
No, I mean, you're looking through the camera because you want to see what the camera sees. And, you know, the camera is this technological, you know, it's a device. It sees what's there. It's like a little Buddha. It doesn't have your expectations and your anxieties, and it's clinical. And the hardest thing is to really see what it is seeing.
Oh, you have to learn that, don't you?
Yeah, it takes a while. You have to really divest yourself of a lot of your own anxieties and try to be present and honest.
Well, as I said, there were many films we could have chosen, but I did choose Defiance.
Okay.
And I don't know if you agree with this or not. Someone said, well, this is like Glory for Jews. I don't know if that fits your...
That's really funny.
your vision of this particular film. But this is a scene from your film, Defiance, based on the true story of Jewish partisans who sheltered Jews in a forest in Belarus and fought off the Nazis. Daniel Craig plays Tuvia Bielski, and in this scene is speaking to a frightened group of survivors.
Friends, this is the happiest day of my life, to see you here, safely amongst us. But there are a few things you must learn about living here. When you are rested and settled, you will be assigned work duties. Everyone will work. There are no exceptions. We will help supply our Russian partisan comrades. We will mend clothes. We will repair weapons. Women will learn to shoot, and they will fight alongside men. Pregnancies are forbidden. We cannot accommodate an infant's needs here. Today, we will start rebuilding the lives you have all lost. This is the one place in all of Belarus where a Jew can be free. We welcome you into our community.
And as, again, a scene from Defiance. You wrote something in the New York Times, Shadows of Valiant Ancestors. You said, my grandfather, Itzki, was a tough Jew. I'm named after him. My Hebrew name is Yitzhak. In the 20s, Chicago, his five brothers, the uncles as they were known, Dovey, Fat, Zeus, Zell, and Jules, were, quote, betting commissioners, i.e. bookies for the Capone mob. As a boy, I secretly relished my family's unsavory past.
Yeah. I think in some sense, the closest I could get was to be a film director, but that involves a certain amount of toughness and a certain amount of will and a certain amount of theatricality.
And these guys were, so they were your...
They're my father's uncles.
Oh, father's uncles.
My father's uncles, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And my father actually recalled as a very young boy having seen Capone. When he came out of prison, he was very, very old and very sick, but what he felt when he saw him.
This was an article about why you wanted to make Defiance.
Uh-huh.
I mean, basically saying, someone said, no, this is a story of Jewish heroes like the Maccabees, only better.
Yeah, I mean, look, it is the most remarkable story, and obviously it is in line with something I do believe, which is to say, if the facts conform to dramatic truth, then it's a story you can make a movie of. But I wasn't about to invent a story. It has to be remarkable in its own renown. It has to be intrinsically, complete. And this was the most remarkable story. And it was really brought home to me when we were there in Belarus, freezing our asses off and wearing down and Gore-Tex and... Sorel boots and whatever, and realize that these people did this for three Russian winters with wet leather clothes and newspaper stuffed in their shoes. And you realize this was one of the truly remarkable moments in human history.
We're almost out of time here. Are there movies that you keep going back to that you have loved your whole life?
Of other people.
Of
course, constantly. I mean, gosh, there are so many. I mean, it's... you know, The Seven Samurai is a teaching course in film direction. Any movie by Renoir is this window into the human condition. There are people, there are American directors who were, you know, idols to me. And some, Sidney Pollack was a kind of mentor to me, and his movies, you know, really were important to me. And, oh gosh, it's too many. I could go on. This would be the next hour.
You also have a long-standing partnership with Marshall Herskovitz.
A Philadelphia native.
I was going to say a Philadelphia native. See, everything does have something to do with Philadelphia. Without him, can you imagine what your career would be?
No, we met our first day in film school. I mean, we have been each other's, obviously, best friends, first brothers, scourges, teachers. You know, what we discovered very early is there was no continuing education and few people that would continue to tell you the truth after you begin to do well. And we have been that for each other, too, a kind of litmus or
I mean, and to have someone to tell you the truth.
It's worth everything.
It's worth everything. Well, Edward Zwick, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And we've been talking about making movies. He's got a new one, Trial by Fire, and it opens on May 17th. Closing out with some music from Glory, the soundtrack, after Antietam, composed and conducted by James Horner, performed by the Boys Choir of Harlem. After this short break, we'll be talking about organizing in the gig economy. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Drivers for Uber and Lyft staged work stoppages on Wednesday in major cities around the world, protesting low pay, deteriorating working conditions, and broken promises. Here in Philadelphia, about 80 protesters rallied in front of the Uber Greenlight Hub near the airport, organized by the Philadelphia Drivers Union and the Philadelphia Limousine Association. There's nothing new about workers striking, but organizing in the gig economy has its unique challenges. Joining us is Todd Wolfson. He's professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, co-director of the Media Inequality and Change Center, or MIKE Center, and he is a longtime collaborator with the Taxi Workers Alliance of Pennsylvania, here to talk about organizing in the gig economy. Todd Wolfson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Well, talking about this work stoppage or this strike on Wednesday, and it was not just in Philly, but across the country and actually around parts of the world. Was it successful from your perspective?
Yeah, I think it was very successful. I think you'll hear people say that it didn't crash markets, so Philadelphia was still operating. People could still get their Ubers maybe a minute or two longer. But an action at this level of workers that are so disaggregated is a huge step forward. And the fact that it wasn't only across the U.S., but rather had touchdown spots across the globe is just very impactful and bodes well for workers standing up in this new gig economy.
And I do want to talk about all of that, but I think we need to define what the gig economy is, just to make sure everyone knows or is on the same page.
Right. I mean, people have gotten work by the gig since time immemorial. And in fact, in the early days, one of the big fights was to move from getting work by the gig to getting work, getting daily wages to getting annual wages. So that's been a long fight. But the new gig economy, maybe we could call it, is people who are getting work usually mediated through their phone, and they're being paid by the task. And then there's still multiple types of gig work within that. There's people who are creating a design for somebody in China, so very distanced. But then there's on-demand, geographically bound gig economy, which is what we're seeing the most action from. And that's people who are doing work on demand, you know, somebody picking you up in an Uber, somebody dropping off your food, a domestic worker, who are being hired by On Demand and are geographically located.
And the phone is the conduit, right?
And the phone is absolutely the conduit.
And as you said, there's nothing new, but what is new is this technology.
It's definitely the technology itself is new. And I think at a meta level, what's also new is, or not new, but a new problem we're facing is the rollback of workers' rights within this milieu.
Right. Well, and I think the Uber-Lyft protests, which their complaints are about working conditions, about wages, about broken promises, on and on and on from there. And on the one hand, yes, you can organize people using social media, but can you make the kind of changes that these workers want through social media?
I think this is the struggle we're going to watch unfold to come. So in some places, workers are making huge gains. So in the UK, Uber drivers have taken Uber to court, and they actually won worker status. And in the UK, there's three statuses: employees, independent contractors, and between workers. They won in court. They beat two appeals, and they're going to the Supreme Court. And if they win that, all workers who drive for Uber will be classified as workers. They'll get minimum wage, they'll get paid holiday, and they'll have collective bargaining rights. In the U.S., it's not quite that simple because we only have two classifications, independent contractors and workers. And so this or employees, excuse me. So the struggle will look a little bit, it'll go on a little bit longer. But I do think there's real possibility for them to win real gains. Just from the May 8th protests, we saw Uber settle with a bunch of drivers, 60,000 drivers who have said they've been misclassified. Uber has now announced a settlement since the strikes on Wednesday. So we saw huge gains already, and they put aside, I think, $130 million to pay out those claims.
And in New York City, if you're a driver, Uber driver, or maybe even a Lyft driver, a driver as well, you do get paid. I mean, it's New York City, $16-17 an hour, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So they passed a set of bills about last summer, which both set a wage floor for Uber and Lyft drivers, and also cap the number of cars coming into the city. Some of that's still being worked out, but yes, they did. And that came on the heels, it should be marked, of an epidemic of cab drivers and Uber drivers that killed themselves because of the conditions in New York City. Some of them very explicitly saying they could not make a living. And I think somebody self-immolated actually at City Hall.
Self-immolated.
By City Hall in New York City. So the response by the city was based on what was a real crisis, and a crisis that's going to spread. It's not just going to be in New York City.
It's interesting you said Uber drivers and taxi drivers, because I think we often think they're either in competition or sort of represent different parts of our economy.
They don't.
They don't.
And often somebody is driving for Uber on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday and driving a cab on Tuesday and Thursday. So I mean, I think what we've seen in New York is the organizing that passed those bills was organizing that connected cab drivers to Uber drivers and built a very powerful kind of coalition. And hopefully, as we move forward, we'll see coalitions like that, because they're both suffering in this economy.
And is the future more gig work? I mean, is that what you see as you look into your crystal ball?
Yes. I mean, I think that's the danger in front of us. It's not only – I mean – the economists who have studied this will tell you that the numbers are pretty small of gig workers right now, maybe 1%. Right. They vary. But what the real danger is them setting a model for how work is understood in the generations to come, so that our children and our children's children don't expect the kind of benefits, a 40-hour week, getting health care on the job, getting benefits with the job, having collective bargaining rights. They won't expect those things. So the real danger is resetting how we understand work.
I would assume for some gig workers, it is what they want. That they want some extra money, some disposable cash. They're not looking for a full-time job with benefits, but they want some flexibility in their work-home life, if I can put it that way.
Absolutely. So I think even if you just look at Uber and Lyft drivers, you'll see a slight majority that are doing it part-time.
Right.
Maybe they're making extra money, or they're in school and they're paying bills, etc. And then a minority, but only a slight minority, that are doing it full-time. But the minority that are doing it full-time do the large majority of the rides for these companies. So And they're the ones that are suffering the most. I think the people who are doing it part-time are happier with the job, tend to have less grievance generally.
Because they're not looking to make a living off it. They're looking to make some extra cash.
Exactly.
And the Uber Lyft drivers, what specifically do they want?
I think they want, in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Drivers Union and Philadelphia Limousine Association have called for a few things, $20 an hour minimum wage. So they want a wage floor. They want to stop the activation. So the other thing about this is Uber drivers and Lyft drivers are driving and an algorithm all of a sudden deactivates them, which is the equivalent of firing them. And the drivers have no recourse and no way of getting back their job. And it's very hard and arcane to get in touch with Uber and Lyft. And so there's no real management. You're managed by an algorithm. And so and the algorithm also chooses to fire you because maybe you've come down 0.01 in
your
ratings. Exactly. And so I think they want to stop the activation. And then they want Uber to not have the right, and Lyft, to not have the right to change the conditions of work. So in L.A., what started much of this was starting in L.A. when Uber decided to cut 25% or 25 cents, I'm not sure actually, per mile off Uber drivers. And that
off
led
their
to,
pay.
Off their pay, and that led to a strike on March 25th, symbolically. And then the May 8th strike was a follow-up strike that then spread.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and I'd love to hear from our listeners as well. Uber drivers or Lyft drivers or people that use these hailing services, that's Todd Wolfson, professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, and again, co-director of the Media Inequality and Change Center. And we're talking about how to organize in the gig economy. And there was a series of work stoppages on Wednesday across the United States here in Philly, also around the world, protesting against things like low pay, deteriorating work conditions, broken promises. And I should add that Uber is doing their bid for money on Wall Street today, looking, I think, for something like $90 billion. Let me read a comment from Bailey. I was at the rally and I'm currently an Uber driver. I think it's ridiculous that this company treats its only resource, its drivers, so poorly when top executives are taking home so much money.
Exactly. I mean, that's the problem, is Uber is built on drivers. It would not have a business without the drivers, but it treats them like second, third class citizens and is not really all that concerned when they're struggling to make a living. And so this is the core. We've seen it throughout time. It's not new, but this is a new phase of the struggle of workers to get some respect, some democracy in the workplace, and to be able to feed their families while working full time.
Is it because the owners or the management is heartless, or because we've got these algorithms that are essentially sort of running the business?
The algorithms are running the business in many ways, but the algorithms respond to the priorities of the people who own Uber. Technology is just a tool of the people who own the business. So it is a new business model. It's a new business model that they pitch is for people who are part-time. But that's just not the reality of it. I would say that it's the imperatives of Uber to make as much of a profit as possible and do that on the backs of drivers.
So people that use these services and enjoy the convenience and the cost, what should they do? I mean, if they want to stand in solidarity with their drivers, what do you do?
Well, first, I think it's important to mark that this will affect consumers as well. So the problems with Uber, one study has shown that in cities like Philadelphia, traffic has doubled with the rise of Uber and Lyft. So in fact, they just did a study in San Francisco that said 2/3 of the new traffic in San Francisco is due to Uber and Lyft, period.
Wow.
And that is not only like our quality of life trying to get around our cities, but it's also climate, right? Our climate change will be fed by this. So standing with workers is also standing for ourselves. And the last thing I'll say is when workers aren't making enough they don't get health care on the job, they end up in the emergency room, and we all pay that bill when Uber should be paying that bill. So I think a way to stand up, there is no strike now, and the workers are working, and I think they want people to use Uber and use cabs, so people certainly should. But people should stand up. And when there is a strike call, they should respect what people have called the digital picket line and not cross it, not use it. And people should let the companies know that they're concerned about the work conditions of the workers.
it's hard to strike, but even harder is to use the strike to get the things that you want. I mean, that has been, there's nothing new about that again. I mean, this is how you force benefits or you force better pay out of management.
Absolutely. No worker wants to strike, take off days, not make a living. It's never comfortable. But in order to move us all forward, some workers have taken it on themselves to stand up. And we have seen, again, massive gains just from May 8th. But also we've seen, and this is important, a global network developing. So folks who are organizing in London are in touch with the amazing organizers in Philadelphia, and they're talking. They're talking to the organizers in L.A., who are talking to the organizers in Chicago and New York. And so I think people are starting to problem solve together and figure out that while there are particularities to the struggle in Philadelphia, there's also a global problem and we can face it together.
And is it Facebook? Is that the mode of communication?
I think there's a lot of modes. I think within cities, people have been using Facebook to organize drivers, certainly. I think in London, WhatsApp is an app that's really heavily been used. And Twitter has also been used. So people are using all sorts of models, and the networks and relationships are starting to be built. And one thing to flag about this is it is a workforce that doesn't get to see each other. There's no office they're going to. But when we've seen when they do get to know each other that they've been able to stand up. A good case of this is food couriers in throughout the UK and Europe work slightly differently than food couriers in the US. They all aggregate at one site. Oh. And they've built relationships at that site. And so they've built those relationships, they've built networks, and then when there's been problems, they've struck. And so there's been something like 45 work actions by food couriers in the UK and throughout Europe in the last 2 to 3 years. It's been a massive strike wave, and it's because those relationships have been built, and then they've been able to use social media once those relationships have built to say, the owner's doing X, let's stand up now. And so relationships that are physical have really led to much better organizing.
Oh, that's so interesting. And Uber, as I understand it, wants to get into the food delivery business. I mean, they see that as part of their business model. And it should be said, it's a company that has not turned a profit yet. So.
It has not turned a profit yet. And yes, they do have Uber Eats. And Uber Eats is in operation here in Philly at this point. So, and again, the vision of the gig economy, right now we see it most with domestic workers, point-to-point transportation drivers, delivery, and with food delivery, but it's growing.
Yeah.
Many other sectors are looking at this model as a model that they want to in-house. Even like science labs are using and starting to look at the gig model as a way to bring in workers. So it's a little disturbing.
Here's an email from Steve. He says, I was a bike messenger for many years and worked for all different app-based companies. These companies claim to take responsibility for injuries on the job, but I never knew anyone to receive a payout.
Yes, and that's been a problem. It's been a problem in Philadelphia. Unfortunately, a food courier passed away. He was biking on the job for caviar when he passed. And then there was a bunch of food couriers got together and they fought. And I think they did end up winning a little bit of a payout, maybe. But it was not. They did not take responsibility without the other food couriers stepping up and demanding it.
Well, Todd Wolfson, thank you so much for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's a professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers University, co-director of the Media Inequality and Change Center. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.